Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Welcome this afternoon to Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Bender in for Neil Stavem once again today, and just grateful to be here. Grateful also for the beautiful weather we have here in Minnesota. These are the days where I say, I can't wait for summer.
It feels good.
It's here. Yeah. It has arrived. Well, I had this stack of books on my table this week, and of course, one of them was the book that we're talking about today. And it's called Toughest People to Love. And, of course, I live in a home of smart alecks, I guess is the best way to say it. And my husband said, oh, an autobiography.
Oh. Shots fired.
And then my 13-year-old, who's always on his mom, said, on his mom's side, said, Dad, I think it's a book about you.
Uh-huh.
So there we go.
There you go.
I know. So that's what it's like to be at the Bender household for dinner each night.
So you're going to employ some of these tactics we learned today here, then?
Yes, I think so. Well, as I read it, I thought, you know, there's a lot of truth in this book, and neither of those statements were true. It's neither an autobiography, nor is it about my husband. But I'm sure there's glimpses of each of us in here.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. We all run into those people that are hard to love.
Yes, and I can be one of those people who is hard to love. So it's humbling to read a paragraph and say, oh, I think I've done that. So you may have a person in your life who you might say is tough to love. Maybe that's someone at work. Maybe that's someone that you are in charge of leading. Or maybe that person does look a little bit like you. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about that, explore the basics of what it means to lead a person who might be tough to love with our guest for today. Let me tell you a little bit about him, and then we can get started with the show. Chuck DeGroat is an associate professor of pastoral care and counseling at Western Theological Seminary in Holland, Michigan, and he's also a former teaching pastor of City Church San Francisco and executive director of City Church's Counseling Center. He's also the author of another good book, Leaving Egypt, Finding God in Wilderness Places. Welcome, Chuck.
Good to talk with you, Joe.
Well, good to talk with you, too. How did you decide that this was a book that was not only worth writing, but worth getting in the hands of a lot of people?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. I went on Twitter, and I was thinking about another book, and had a couple of ideas, but I jumped on Twitter, and I've got a number of friends in pastoral ministry. I've been in pastoral ministry for 15-plus years. I just asked the question, what would be most helpful to you? And I got probably 20 responses, and 18 of them had to do with dealing with difficult people, and I thought, you know, that's it. We all have to do it, whether we're pastors, leaders in any capacity. We all have to deal with very difficult people, like your husband, it sounds like. So that's why I wrote the book.
Oh, good. Well, yes, my husband falls in the he thinks he's very funny category. So, you know, and that's good. That's why I married him, that quick wit. And keeps me on my toes. So it's really wonderful. But I've also been in pastoral ministry. And so I resonated with a lot of what you wrote. And it's true that how you set up the book is saying that a lot of us will get so frustrated, not with the job that we are charged to do, but with the people who are in the way of us doing our job. And we get so focused on that it drains us of the energy that we need to do our job. Have you found that to be true with people who are in pastoral ministry or any capacity where they're leading people?
Yeah. I mean, I think I found it to be true across the board. I think in particular, as I've talked to pastors and as I look back at my own experience, it wasn't some theological debate or preparing a sermon or a talk or anything like that. It was people that almost drove me out of ministry about 3 years in. The difficulty of ministering to the toughest people, of course, but then coming full circle to have to deal with myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of where I end the book. But it requires us to ask questions about who we are and how we're processing life and what triggers we have that come up as we deal with the most difficult people.
I remember feeling that way when I decided that my 7-year-old could have 10 friends over for his birthday. And my 7-year-old was just one of those kids who listened. He just was a great kid. I mean, he still is, but he's older now. Was a great kid. I thought, well, I can have 10 of him over. Well, it was not 10 of him. It was not 10 of my son who listens to me over. It was 10 people who don't know who I am and don't listen to me. And all of a sudden, that party became not very fun for me. And I remember that night telling my husband, I am never going to do that again. And he said something like, you know, you need to figure out why you're not okay with the chaos that happens, because it's okay. And it's kind of what you were just saying. You know, we go into these situations and feel completely qualified and equipped to minister, to lead. And then we get to the point where it's not working out the way that we thought or what we learned in class or in a textbook, because there's people involved. And why can't I deal with my reaction to those people instead of thinking that it's all them?
Yeah, there is something, I think, kind of idealistic, maybe even a bit narcissistic, about those of us who are pastors. And particularly when we're training for pastoral ministry, there is a sense that someday when I'm done with seminary, I'll ascend into a pulpit and I'll preach a fantastic sermon and people will come up to me afterwards and say, thank you, Pastor. And what they don't realize is that there's that Monday morning email that they get from someone who says that was the worst sermon or didn't connect with me at all, or our previous preacher was so much better than you. And that's the kind of stuff. That's the kind of stuff that is really difficult.
Yes, and email is difficult. In fact, I was just talking the other day about how I used to do this type of thing, but on television. And my favorite thing was to answer the phone after a show, because people would be so surprised that they got me. And instead of just sending off a quick little email about something they were going to criticize, they would get me live. And then they'd be like, oh, Joe, oh, is this is you? Oh, and then their comment would be so much softer. But email is difficult. So what has been your experience as you've been dealing with people and yourself on identifying who might be those toughest people to love?
Yeah, well, in the book, I provide a number of different categories. Let's just take one of those categories, and there are a number of different things that we can talk about. But I think there's a chapter in there about loving foolish people, using the biblical category of foolishness to wisdom. The way I understand that is a wise person is someone who's able to see their blind spots, a person who's willing to repent when they've sinned against another, a person that is willing to enter into a conversation where there might be something difficult revealed about them, but they say, you know what, I want to hear and I want to have the opportunity to apologize for what I've done. I think as we move down that spectrum into what the Bible calls foolishness, there are levels of sort of like increasing ignorance and inability or incapacity to see our own stuff and to own our own stuff. And I think that's what I've experienced within the church, is those folks who don't see the kind of hurricane that they produce through the drama of their life, or the kind of the power that they employ in a community group or small group, for instance, that just overwhelms everyone else. And when you do step into a conversation with them and say, hey, can I give you some feedback? They're quick to turn it back around on you. I think that's what's really tough. Is we're all broken. We all sin. We all make mistakes. We all stumble and fall. But it's the folks who aren't able to see their stuff and own it that might be the most difficult people.
And so you do write quite a bit about that as leaders or parents or teachers or anyone who's dealing with other people in our work or even in our personal life. One of the steps to better understand someone else's story is to better understand our story first.
Right.
And what are some good ways to get started along that path, especially for those who are in a high leadership position where maybe it would be looked down upon for them to do some personal reflection? What's some ways that they can kind of get started?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's a big question. And part of it is to convince someone that they have a story that they have to tell that is worth telling. You know, one of the best-selling Christian books of all time is St. Augustine's Confessions, where Augustine reviews his life and talks about how he's stumbled and sinned and fallen. And I think I think it's important for Christians as they look at their lives, not just to look at the facts, like I grew up in New York, my eyes are green, I'm married to Sarah, but sort of like the rhythms and the movements of their lives. We've got to, I think, begin to look at the relational matrix that we grew up in. And this is not to start some sort of conversation about what mom or dad did to us that was bad and to blame them for something. That's not the point at all. But it is to see the kind of relational environment that we grew up in and how, because of that, we relate in certain ways today. So it's as simple as beginning with the question, how did my earliest relationships impact me? And in a sense, guide me into a certain way of relating in my own life.
Well, and it seems like it would help to say, oh, that's why I, or whatever you can fill in the
right.
blanks. But like those aha moments might actually help us in determining why we react a particular way. And then that's maybe the first step to changing the way that we
right.
might react to that particular
That's right. The present moment is the key here, is being aware of how we relate, being aware of, I think the best question we can ask a friend sometimes is, how do you experience me? Mm. How do I impact you? And to get an honest answer, I mean, sometimes we're too nice to one another. Oh, you're so great. I love you. You're so smart. Instead of saying, you know, there are times when you can come across as aggressive, or you can feel kind of distant. Or when we're talking and it doesn't feel like you're really tuned into what I'm saying. That's some of the best feedback we can give to another so that we can become a bit more curious about, why do I relate in that way?
Well, and there might actually be positive things there too, because people
exactly.
may perceive us better than we are thinking they are perceiving us, and that could end up being encouraging to us along the way as well.
Exactly. It works both ways.
Well, I'm talking to author Chuck DeGroat today. Chuck has a wide variety of experience in pastoral care and counseling. He's written a fabulous book called Toughest People to Love, How to Understand, Lead, and Love the Difficult People in Your Life, Including Yourself. We have several copies of Chuck's book to give away. If you're listening today and want to get that in someone's hands or in your own hands, you can give us a call at 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Or maybe you'd like to just join in on the conversation, share a story or two about you experiencing a tough person to love, or doing a little self-discovery and how that has helped you in leading other people. We'd love to hear that as well. You can call us at 877-933-2484 or go to myfaithradio.com and click on Connecting Faith. You can certainly submit a request for a book that way, or you can submit a comment as well. We'll be right back on Connecting Faith. Connecting Faith this afternoon. I'm Joe Bender in for Neil Stavem today, and we're talking with author Chuck DeGroat about the toughest people to love. Maybe you have some people who are tough to love in your life, be that personally or professionally, and maybe you're leading or trying to lead some people who you may consider to be tough to love. We're talking about getting to our own story and figuring out maybe why we react the way we do, but there's also another side, and that's their story. Chuck, you tell a story in your book about someone you considered to be a master intimidator when you were doing pastoral ministry. And you tell about how someone suggested to you that maybe you should get to know a little bit about their story. Talk a little bit about that experience for you.
Yeah, that was an important moment. A friend of mine was aware of how the hard time that I was having dealing with this particular person. I was in a clinical internship at the time, and every time I'd leave my appointment with this person, I'd say, you know what, he's just a mess, he'll never grow, he'll never change. And she came to me at one point and said something to the effect of, well, have you ever considered that he has a story? And I said, no, I just considered that he's annoying and he's hard to be with. And she said, well, why don't you employ a bit of curiosity and wonder a bit about why he's become the kind of person that he has become today? We all have a story. I knew that in my head, but it dropped down into my heart at that point. When it was sort of that aha moment that you mentioned earlier, when it dawned on me, I can be curious. I can be curious about this man. It's just not what I'm experiencing in the room. There might be a story that is filled with pain or doubt or disappointment that I just don't know about yet. And it changed my whole relationship with this man. He experienced me as less defensive or antagonistic as his therapist in those early counseling sessions, and we began to connect at a deeper level.
Well, and it seems like that concept of thinking first about they may have a story too, they may have been going through something difficult.
Right.
That
right.
is not a natural reaction that comes to right. many of us.
That's right. No, that's right. I mean, our default is to be reactive and not reflective. We're learning about this, by the way, in the world of interpersonal neurobiology, that we live out of our amygdala, our reptilian brain. We're reactive people. So we sort of respond out of fear sometimes instead of stepping back and saying, well, what's really going on here? Am I being attacked? Or is this person just sort of living out of a narrative that he's always lived out of? And I have an opportunity now to maybe be someone different, not just do something different, but be someone different in his life. And so it's this profound privilege that I have as a therapist, as a pastor, as a professor, to sit with people and be that kind of different person that they can experience. So, and in those moments, I mean, I think you probably know this, people's defenses go way down and they begin to feel safe and we can really begin to connect.
Well, there are lots of people who are probably listening thinking, well, I'd like to connect with people. I'd like to connect with people in my own family. What's a good way to start asking about those stories? I mean, for an example, I've often said, well, why does my mother react like this, you know, when well, something happens? And then I remember talking to her sister, my aunt, about it, and she said, well, let me tell you what it was like growing up in my family.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, my goodness, it has taken me this long to finally hear that. And then I gained this great sense of understanding of my own family life then because of that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. I was sitting with someone the other day who had one of those moments where she had been she'd sort of just gone through the motions with her family for 10, 15 years since she'd left for college and gotten married. And we had been talking about story, and she said, you know, I just can't imagine doing anything like that or having that kind of conversation. How would I even start? And very courageously, she stepped into a conversation with her sister and said, you know, we always talk about kind of like benign things. We talk about our kids. We talk about our marriage. That's all fine. But can we talk for a few minutes about what it was like growing up in our home? How did you experience it? And that was the only thing she said. How did you experience it? And in that moment, her sister began to tear up. And she said, you know, I've been wanting to have this conversation with you for probably 10, 15 years now myself. Mm-hmm. It was a very anxious home. And I think sometimes my own anxiety is a kind of byproduct of growing up in such an anxious home. Sometimes it just means asking the question beyond the question, like it's getting to the subtext, getting to the next level of relationship with a family member, and that's where it all begins.
Mm. Well, ironically, we have someone who's calling in who has a question about bringing unity into her family. Can I take that call?
Excellent. Yes.
Hi there. Okay, this is like the perfect subject for me because I'm going to see my dysfunctional family this weekend. And I was raised in a home where my father was very, very disrespectful to my mom, always treated her rudely. And so that is ingrained in us kids. Plus, there's just no unity between us. And yet, we are all drawn together as a family because of my mother and so forth. So I guess, like, I don't even know. I try to bring unity myself, but people don't cooperate. And I'm saying this humbly because I'm certainly not the best at this either. But I truly do want to make an effort, and I just feel so frustrated. And I actually feel like it's almost beyond hope.
Yeah. So you talk about bringing unity. It sounds like you just want your family to be more connected. Like, you just want them to get along, right?
Yeah. Well, for instance, you know, when we celebrate Christmas together or Thanksgiving, it'd be fun to sit down and engage in a game and laugh together. And that is the most difficult thing to do. And you wouldn't think that, but people just aren't, like, there's like a cloud of division when we're together. It's just not even enjoyable.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me ask you a question. Now, obviously this isn't a counseling session, so we can't talk for a while, what would it be like to ask the question, to sit down with your family in that context and say, what would it be like for us to have a conversation about how we interact with one another? Or what would it be like for us to sit down and talk about how we relate? Could you ever imagine asking a question like that, or is that just a non-starter?
You know, I think that sounds so good and inviting. And I don't know that we've all four been in a room where we could do that, but that sounds so good, because I know that when my brother and I, we see our childhood much differently, because I brought up something that happened to us as a child, and he said, well, we were just kids. And then to me, it has been such a traumatic event to me.
Yeah.
So I really like that, how we see things differently, and that it would be good to talk about it.
Yeah, I think people long to have meaningful conversations like that. I just think we don't give ourselves the opportunity for it. We default back into our old conversations and our old patterns. And so sometimes it's not about keeping the unity, as in like peacekeeping. I think of the Beatitudes, blessed are the peacemakers. It's not about peacekeeping. It's about peacemaking. And sometimes that's even a little disruptive. Sometimes that means asking that question, hey, how do we all relate to one another? How have we gotten to this point where it's hard for us to be in the same room? And, you know, sometimes those conversations don't go so well, but I've often seen that those conversations begin a whole new journey for a family or for a couple.
Thanks so much for calling. And you know what? I always had a person who, one of my mentors, who said, what's the worst thing that can happen if you do ask the question? And that was really good for me, because I thought I had conjured up all these things in my mind of how someone would react if I were to ask a question like that. Hey, can we talk about your experience and how you experience something? And I had conjured up that conversation would go poorly. But my mentor said, well, what's the worst that can happen? Will they stand up and leave the room? Will they tell you something that you don't want to hear? Or could there actually be a conversation that takes place? And are you willing to take that risk?
Right. Yeah, that's so good. And it's so courageous to do that. I think the bottom line is I'm just scared sometimes. I don't want to have that hard conversation. So we have to muster up that courage that I think comes from the Spirit within, right? I mean, I think it's God living within us, helping sort of muster up that courage within.
Mm-hmm. Well, talking to author Chuck DeGroat today just about toughest people to love, those people in our lives who we may have a hard time with building relationship and keeping relationship. We'll chat more about that when we come back after the break with Chuck DeGroat on Connecting Faith. Ted, that's the perfect song for this interview.
Lee Bryce.
Yes. Good. Way to go, Lee. Hard to love. I feel that way a lot, and maybe you do too. Maybe you consider yourself to be a tough person to love. And I can tell you, yes, if you were my boss, I kind of feel bad for you, because you have to deal with me and many other people. Do you think Neil is listening today?
He's out west somewhere. I think you're safe.
Well, I've tried to do my homework of figuring out why I'm tough to love. Maybe you've done that as well. We're talking with author Chuck DeGroat today about toughest people to love, how to understand, lead, and love the difficult people in your life, including yourself. And we've been talking a little bit specifically about if you are pastoring a group of people or leading a group of people. What are some of those specific personality disorders, Chuck, of people who you might be able to identify and then help?
Yeah. Well, so in the book, I've got a chapter devoted to personality disorders. And I don't, first of all, let me just say, I don't love putting people in categories. Mm-hmm. In part because I'm the kind of person that would just, I'd use that against someone. That's just how dark my heart is, you know. You're just a blank.
Right.
But I think sometimes it's helpful just to get a sense of kind of what you're feeling and experiencing. And I name a few different personality disorders that psychologists talk about. Narcissistic personality disorder, histrionic, mm-hmm. borderline personality disorder, and obsessive compulsive personality disorder. These are sort of the dominant personality patterns that give pastors and leaders some trouble in ministry.
So what is it? Is it helpful to identify those to figure out why someone might be reacting the way that they are? Or is it helpful to just find out more information about how to deal with that type of personality so that you can bring some unity?
Yeah, well, I think that sometimes it's helpful because you as a pastor or a leader will just feel a little bit less crazy when you know that maybe there's something else going on. Let me just give you an example. I just mentioned borderline personality disorder. It's a kind of push-pull. This is a person who, I remember someone very early on in ministry who came to me and wanted to volunteer and do some things. Was very kind and very gracious, and I thought, oh, this is the kind of person that I like to minister to and with. And, not 6 months in, something went awry. There's something that happened within the context of our relationship, and she completely turned. And I didn't understand it because I thought we were connected, and I thought we had a growing pastoral friendship. But what I came to realize, and I had been trained as a therapist by this time, what I came to realize was that there was a lot of pain in this person. Mm. And fundamentally, what was going on in her was not really about me. It was just that she was sensing that perhaps our relationship was replaying a dynamic that goes way back in her life. And so that's probably not the best explanation, but it is to say that you feel a little bit less crazy when you have some categories to hang people on.
Mm. Well, and it seems like you can start from a position of at least some education around that, and that might be a good place to start from, especially when you just throw up your hands like, I don't know what to do with this situation.
Yeah. So, and that's why I provide that chapter, just to give you some basic insight into folks that you'll run up against in ministry and in leadership. And I can't tell you how many people. In fact, I think the book got started because I had done some blogging on this, and I had pastors coming to me and saying, hey, can you give me more? Because I think I have someone who you would define as histrionic, this kind of big, dramatic hurricane of a personality. And I just want this person to leave the church. But I think what you're inviting me to is to see that sort of, as I describe it, the quiet eye of the storm in the midst of the hurricane. And I think sometimes what we do is we react to the behavior that we're getting, and we forget to remember that there's something else going on inside, that there's a quiet inner center where God resides, and that God loves this person in the depths of his or her soul. And I've got to get through that maybe dramatic or powerful or manipulative exterior to that quiet center. It's tough to do, but it gives me hope for people.
Well, and it goes along with a lot of what you say in the entire book is get to know that person's story, because
right.
you might be able to join in on that story and maybe change the trajectory of the way they've been going, because this may be the first time that someone has shown them this care and concern and acceptance so that they can possibly understand what it means to be cared for and loved.
Yeah, that's right. One of the biblical motifs that I find so good for this is in Genesis chapter 3, when Adam and Eve are in the garden, they've sinned, they've covered themselves in fig leaves, and they're hiding. And the first three words out of God's mouth is, where are you? Where are you? And it's kind of this kindness that comes from God, even to Adam and Eve in the midst of their hiddenness. And I think that we become conduits of God's, where are you? And I find myself channeling that, through the Spirit who resides in my being. It's God through me saying, where are you? Why are you hidden? Come on out. There's more for you. There's more life for you. There's more hope for you. You don't have to remain hidden anymore.
Well, and how helpful to know that there is someone who wants to know more. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I'll be reacting in a negative way or an impatient way to my kids as they come home, and I'll just have to stop and say, I just need a little bit of a break. And for my son to come and say, is there something going on? Or my husband to say, is there something going on? It immediately alleviates that tension that had nothing to do with them in the first place. But the fact that someone cared enough to risk asking that question is such a great experience for the person who might be hurting for whatever reason it is.
Yeah, that's right. That's where, the most important word for me in this is curiosity. And oftentimes I'll go and I'll speak to groups of pastors and I'll say, I bet this word is not in your theological dictionary. And curiosity, it looked like to move towards someone with a sense of empathy and humility and curiosity, just wanting to know what might be going on. It's so tough because I think our default often is to think that to get defensive or reactive. None of us want to be pushed into a corner. And at times, I don't know about you, but when I'm particularly tired or stressed, that's my default reaction, is to kind of come back with a left hook after I feel like I get the right hook in my face, and I think it's just helpful to slow down, take a few deep breaths, say, okay, this, like you said, this person has a story. There may be something more going on. Let me just be curious, move toward them, ask a few questions, and there's just such value in that.
Well, and unfortunately for many of us, we get the left hook, but we weren't the person who threw the right hook in the first place. And so you need to dig deep and find out where that right hook came from, and then maybe that left hook won't come quite so swiftly next time.
That's right. That's right. And it takes such courage and such belief that what is most deep in people is God's image, God's presence, and sometimes when I just see people as sort of an accumulation of bad behavior or addictive patterns or narcissistic manipulation, I reduce them to something far less than who they are made in God's image.
You have a great section just on addictions and the importance of understanding not only the addict, but the addiction that they have as well. In fact, you wrote, we are far more addicted than we know and far more in need of grace than we think. Yeah. Talk a little bit more about that. What's been your experience there?
Yeah, right. I mean, we all orient our lives around something, right? There are addictive patterns in each one of our lives. How many of us wake up in the morning and the first thing we do is we grab our smartphone, for instance, or we turn on the TV? And so it might not be that what we might see to be that very dark addictive pattern, the binging and purging pattern or cutting or over-drinking or sex addiction or something like that, but there are patterns in our lives that are not life-giving patterns. I think it's to become aware of what is our story fundamentally oriented around. When I look at my life, sometimes I can see that my story is oriented around me, my own sort of selfish need to for people to approve of me or to get my needs met. And so, if my story is oriented around that, maybe I do wake up and I take a look. How many likes did I get on Facebook or Twitter or something like that? Or what are people saying? Instead of saying, okay, God, who I am in you is far more important than that. And so I'm going to relax into that deep identity that I have as a son, as a daughter of God.
Mm. Well, you share some great strategies as well for how leaders can care for an addict. What's important to know if you're leading someone who is suffering with an addiction?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the important principles in there is to see that the addictive behavior is not what is fundamentally wrong. That's just a symptom. That's a surface level. Think of it in terms of an iceberg. That's just the part of the iceberg that is above the surface and revealed to you. So someone comes to you and says, I think I have an addiction to pornography or to cutting. That's just that little area above the iceberg. Now, I want to deal with that. I don't want the person to cut anymore, look at porn, but I realize that there's far more going on. And so in that chapter, I talk about three layers of movement into a person's life, a kind of functional level where you just sort of get the addiction under control. But then you've got to go to a deeper level where you begin to ask questions and make connections about how this person has oriented his or her world and relationships, how they get their needs met. And then finally, I think we move into the deepest level, and that's how do we experience the more transformative life in God that we're looking for in all our many addictions. And I think any addiction is, in one sense, a search for the transcendent, you know, looking for God in a bottle, looking for God, as G.K. Chesterton said, in a brothel. And so there's a deeper experience of God available to us that when we taste and see it and experience it, sort of makes us look at all of our addictions and say, why in the world would I ever settle for something less than that for which God has made me?
Love that. Well, talking to author Chuck DeGroat today, he's just written a great book on loving people who might seem unlovable. He calls them the toughest people to love, how to understand, lead, and love difficult people in your life, including yourself. We've been talking a little bit about how to lead those people in a position maybe as a pastor or counselor or leader of others. We're also going to answer your questions when we come back. I know there's a couple people holding on the line. I've sent in some questions. I'll get to those when we come back after the break. Again, talking to author Chuck DeGroat on Connecting Faith.
So let's leave it alone, 'cause we can't see eye to eye. There ain't no good guy. There ain't no bad guy. There's only you and me, and we just disagree.
Well, welcome back to Connecting Faith. We've been talking with author Chuck DeGroat today on Toughest People to Love, his new book on how to understand, lead, and love the difficult people in your life, including yourself. Chuck, I have Harold hanging on the line. He's been there for a while. Sorry about that, Harold. I'd love to get your question out to Chuck.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I have a brother-in-law who had a very tough assignment in Vietnam. He came back and I don't know all the details, how it happened or anything else. In fact, I don't know any of those details, but he did molest his two daughters. My sister is still with him, and they're making it, but God has really burdened my heart. I've been praying for him for quite a few years now, and the impression's been coming to me that I need to challenge him to get things right with he and his daughters. Now, I'm no, you know, preacher or counselor or anything else, but I have been praying. A lot of prayers gone into this, and I'm wondering if there's something your guests might share with me that would help as I continue to move into this situation.
Yeah, thank you, Harold. Now, did you say he molested his two daughters?
Correct.
Is that something that was ever dealt with in any kind of... Oh, go ahead. Say again.
It's been over 20 years. And
20 years. Okay.
I'm not sure of what has been done, but I've been developing a friend with as a friend with him, and he and I are begin to trust each other pretty well. We talk a lot, or quite often anyway. And I do have a great love for my sister and for him. And
right.
I feel deep in my spirit that he needs to make a move. I don't think his daughters are going to. But I think he needs to do it. And I don't want to go in there like a bull in a china shop and try to make it
right.
I want to move. We're moving in prayer, but we want to know if there's something we need to consider first.
Yeah. Well, thank you. There are multiple levels of this, I'd say. I mean, one is just I'd want to know if the daughters have gotten the help that they need, because they're victims of sexual abuse and molestation. And so my heart goes out to them. And before any reconciliation happens, they have to take seriously what has happened to them. But I think at the same time, he is a broken and wounded man himself. You don't act out like that unless you've experienced some sort of brokenness in your own life, unless perhaps someone has acted out on you first. So he is both a perpetrator and a victim himself. And it's going to take him, I think, recognizing at some level his own deep brokenness. You know, he probably holds a ton of guilt and shame in his being right now. And to be able to go to him, and again, I know it feels a little bit like you'd go like a bull in a china shop, but to be able to go to him and say, you know, I love you and I want to be with you in this and walk with you through both what you've done and how you've hurt others and how you've been hurt. And I promise to stay with you in the midst of that. A really hard conversation is going to have to happen, but I'm not going to go anywhere. I love you. I think sometimes people just need to know, even if it's going to be a hard conversation, we are in it with them.
Harold, I hope that's been helpful. And Chuck, thanks so much for sharing your wisdom on that. I will for sure make sure, Harold, you get a copy of Chuck's book. We'll get that to you, and we'll pray for you as well. If you could just leave your brother-in-law's name with Carissa so that I can pray specifically, that would be just a real blessing for me to be able to do that. Thanks so much, Harold. We have another question from a listener who emailed in her question. Debbie says, how do you work with teens who blame their parents for everything they do not have? Is that one you've had before?
Well, I have two teenagers, so I can relate. The first thought I had was my friend Sharon Hirsch out in Colorado, Denver, Colorado. Sharon has a few excellent books on this. She and I think a lot alike about these things. But, you know, teenagers they're just kind of working out their stuff, right? Mm-hmm. We need a whole lot of grace and patience. The most important thing, I think, with teenagers is just to stay connected to them relationally. They will screw up just like you screwed up. And there's a kind of necessary narcissism that comes with teenage life. I mean, the psychological language we use is they're kind of like separating and individuating. They're becoming their own people. And I want them to remain just the way I want them to be, you know, and fit my own mold and my own image. But part of what it means to be a dad and a mom is to walk alongside them into the unique image bearing that is theirs. And it will take, there's some pain that you have to walk through. It's sort of like the same pain of labor. You know, you could, now I can't relate to this, Joe, so I'm saying this, I'm saying this from a different perspective, but I think you have to go through this pain and out comes something new, out comes this child. And I think there are similar labor pains in those teenage years, but what you're birthing is an adult. And I think sometimes when we become too rigidly behavioral, and focus more on what our teenagers are doing rather than who they are in their being, rather than connecting with them, we sort of like squelch the deep life of God in them, and we keep them as kids instead of allowing them to become adults. Does that make sense?
Hmm. Well, it makes sense to me, definitely. And the labor thing made sense to me, too. You have to go through a lot of what seems like you'll never get through it, and it will never not be painful. But then something good happens, and it's something better than you could ever imagine. And that's how I feel I'm parenting a teenager as well. And there are just some times where I think, I don't know what to say, and this hurts because he did not used to say these things to me. And yet, then something beautiful will happen, or he will say something that's incredibly caring. And I think hopefully that had something to do with the pain that I went through to get to that point.
That's right. That's exactly right.
But boy, we don't know. We just don't know yet because they're still teenagers. We don't know.
We know. Another friend of mine, Dan Allender, wrote a book called How Children Raise Their Parents, because we have to grow through this time. So as our kids are going through their stuff, I mean, we're so focused on what to do that's right. You know, we want a kind of mechanistic, like mechanical way of raising our kids, but our kids aren't cars. We don't fix them. We connect to them. We relate to them. And relationship is always messy.
Mm. I remember calling a friend of mine who was a few years older than me in the child rearing stage and complaining about potty training. He won't do what I'm trying to tell him to do. He won't do what the books say to do. And
that's
she
right,
finally
that's
just
right.
said, love him. Just love him. He's not going to go to kindergarten in a diaper. Just love him. And I give myself that advice when they're teenagers as well.
Yeah. And God meets us in our exasperation, right? And I just think about how resilient we were when our kids were really young and we weren't getting much sleep. I mean, God meets us in those most dependent places. And so I'm kind of grateful that my kids send me to places of great desperation, because I discovered deeper wells of God's grace in my own life.
It's true. When we go through it, we understand it much more. That's definitely true.
That's right.
Well, Chuck, we have one more caller who sent in a question. I'm going to read it here. She says, my younger sister isn't speaking to anyone in the family or friends. My husband and I have tried to help her in the past, but she completely shuts everyone out. How do you open up lines of communication with a family member who's shutting everyone out?
Yeah. Well, okay, so I don't know all the details of this, but let me just give some a general perspective here. Obviously, something has gone on here that at least feels big to the sister, such that she can't speak to her family anymore, and we don't know what that is. But I think what I tell people oftentimes in situations like this is what we often want to do is we want to write really long emails, for instance, explaining everything that we think has gone on or what needs to happen or what they should do instead of honoring where they are. And I think it may just be as simple as reaching out over a voicemail or an email saying, I long to connect to you again or with you again when it's time, when you're ready. Just leave it at that. And here again, just like we talked about in the previous section here, we have to deal with our own anxiety in the midst of that, our own inadequacy. Maybe we don't feel like we're doing enough to reach out. But it's simply respecting the boundary that she set, saying, hey, I long to connect with you again when you're ready. And, boy, that's hard because we want to be able to control this, you know. There's something that rises up within us that makes us think that if we just write the perfect email or say the perfect thing, we'll get someone to change. And I've just never found that that's the case. And 15 plus years of doing counseling and pastoring.
Great advice. And Jane, if you're still listening, when I'm in that position where I have shut people out, I can tell you this, that the person who makes the effort to say something and ask that one question shows me so much that they care enough to take that risk.
Yeah.
And that's just my personal experience, but maybe the person you're talking about feels that way as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Just if they sense that there's a real relational concern, and not that you're trying to fix them or get them to do something, then that's the big difference.
Well, Chuck, we only have about a minute left. I'm wondering if you'd be willing to just pray for those who are listening today and maybe were afraid to ask the question but really wanted to and have someone in their life they're struggling to connect with. If you could just close us out that would be great.
I would love that. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, I do pray for people who are listening right now who have questions, people who have experienced brokenness in their own lives or perhaps have perpetuated brokenness into the lives of others. I pray that some way, somehow, in the midst of this, your Spirit might be present in this particular time, in this particular issue or space or experience that they're having right now of feeling overwhelmed or confused or anxious or sad or hurt or disappointed. You meet them right there, be present to them right where they are. And in the midst of that, God, begin to do your work of healing, which necessarily means that we have to look at our lives. And so unmask the illusions of our lives, show us all where we are sabotaging relationships, give us the courage to own places of pain in our life and woundedness, and also places where we've perpetuated pain on others. Forgive us, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thanks so much, Chuck. You've been listening to Connecting Faith. Have a great day.